y'all. So I'm here today with another one of our featured authors, Donna Everhart, who is our featured author for Mark. And I have been a fan of hers for years. And this is the first time we've actually met face to face. So I'm so excited to have her. She's the author of five books.
That's right. Yep.
Oh, five books. And her latest is
The Saints of Swallow Hill.
Saints of Swallow Hill. And I have one of the endorsements pulled up to read. You've got some great ones. This from the New York Journal of Books, it says it's a desperate, gritty story set against a backdrop of hard knocks and hard times. Donna Everhart's historically researched The Saints of Swallow Hill is the triumphant story of unlikely bonds fatefully formed among the turpentine camps in the rural Depression era South. I love this book so much. And one of the things I said to you, you know, I was like, I love the Depression era, which, I mean, that sounds so, you know, it was a hard time, but it's one of my favorite times to read about because the stories of the strength and the way people made it through, it was so good to me. But, you know, I'm usually what you read about are the coal mines.
I know.
I did not even know about the turpentine camp.
I know. Well, neither did I. And I come from the state that is known as the Tar Heel State. You know, I know one of the things we wanted to talk about was how did I come to write the book and how did I land on the turpentine camps? And my research tends to kind of meander. And I find myself doing a lot of research on the North Carolina history, like NCpedia. I love that site and I use it a lot. I ran across this term, naval stores, and I had no idea what that was. And then that interest in wanting to understand, well, what is that even about? And most people make the assumption naval stores, something to do with the Navy, but it wasn't. It had to do exactly with what this book is based on, the turpentine camps. And they were prevalent throughout North Carolina and the Southeast in general. There's a little band of longleaf pine trees in the southernmost portion of Virginia, right there at the line of North Carolina. And then there was this huge swath that just followed the eastern seaboard all the way down into South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Florida, Mississippi, over into Louisiana, and then it skips a little bit of land, and it was in eastern Texas as well. So there was this huge longleaf range, a broad range, like 90 million acres when we first came into this type of industry. But it was from the 1700s to the late 1800s. But the bottom line was, the more I did the research on the naval stores, the more I realized that I didn't really want to write about that time frame, 1700s to the 1800s. I already had it in my head. I wanted to write about the Depression era. And what was fascinating was the fact that I realized that these turpentine camps actually existed and were heavy during that time frame, you know, very prevalent. And then even on up into the 1960s. So that was fascinating to me.
Wow. So that's funny. I was going to start this off before we start talking about your books and ask you how you are.
I'm doing great. I'm fine health-wise. I'm great. You know, not a lot of people. Some people know about my journey. I mean, I don't hide it. It's right out there, like on my Instagram account, stage 4 survivor. So I just had a scan in January and that was great. I'm doing every 6 months now. And I passed my 5-year anniversary, you know, which is always a big deal when you're a cancer survivor. But so I am good. I'm
good.
Happy.
Oh, good. Good news. All right. So we're going to jump all over around. I hope that's all right.
That's fine.
Mike's husband used to say that talking to me was like trying to follow an armadillo. Because they hop around when they're excited instead of walking a straight line. So just bear with me.
Oh, you're fine. You're good. We're all good here.
So one of the questions I had for you about your writing, and you ain't kind of answered how you knew you wanted to write about the Depression era.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but then you did all this research. That is so Smart. That's what makes your writing so good. You know, so many authors have an idea, you know, they know exactly what they're going to write and they sit down and they write it. I never do that. Like, I'll have an idea or I'll have a character and I don't know where I'm going to put her or him until that right place just kind of shows itself to me, and then kind of work around that. One of my favorite books of yours that I read was Moonshiner's Daughter. And I'll tell you, you know, when I saw it was an advanced reader copy, I was so lucky. It's when I worked at the bookstore, saw it when it came in and I grabbed it. I assumed it was going to be set like in the Depression era, but it wasn't.
Right.
Oh, and it just blew me away.
Oh, well, thank
just
you.
Talking about it.
I'll take that. That was in a good way.
In a good way. In a good way. So same thing. So did you know you wanted to write a story about a daughter of a moonshiner, and then you thought of the time, or did you know you wanted to write about moonshining at that time?
Yeah, it's so what happens a lot of times for me, and actually to kind of go back to the first part of what you were talking about, my writing in the very beginning was very similar to yours, to the way you approached your story. So I would get a character. I would have this character in my head and I wouldn't have any idea of where I wanted to put her. And it was, you know, some of the stories are launched from research, like The Road to Bittersweet is based on the 1940 flood in Western North Carolina, set in Jackson County. And of course, that wasn't the only county that ended up suffering from that flood, but I chose that county. But the character of Wallace Ann in that book was some character that I'd had in my head already, and I just needed a launch point for her. And it turned out to be that flood. So sort of my inciting incident. And then same thing with The Forgiving Kind, Sonny Creech. I knew I wanted to write about a young girl growing up on a cotton farm who knew how to divine water. Or douse for water. Some people call it divining, some people call it dousing. But with The Moonshiner's Daughter, I knew I wanted to write about moonshining. So I didn't really have the character in my head yet. It was more about moonshine. And so I was researching that. And when it was really popular, or it's been around for a long time, you know, very long time. I knew that I wanted to set it in Wilkes County, which is considered the moonshine capital of the world. But I'll be honest, I think I've heard the same thing from Kentucky and from Tennessee. I think they all each have their own county, maybe. So, I mean, we all kind of share it, you know, because the same things were going on. You know, there was prohibition. People are going to drink. Like, people are going to find ways to drink. What was interesting about all of that research, too, was how they called the ABC stores were the stores that sold the brown liquor. When they eventually came to be, which was in the mid 60s. And that's when, of course, the government knew, OK, well, people are going to drink and we've got to do something about all this moonshining going on. And so they started opening up these government controlled stores, package stores. So for me, the time frame of 1960 really came about because of the research that I was doing. And I also knew that Jesse's monster, and I always like to do these spoiler-free type of conversations for those that haven't read the book yet, but Jesse has something that's called a monster. I knew there was not a lot of help for that at that time. I purposefully wanted that to be the case. In, you know, some roundabout way, that's sort of what set me on a 1960 time frame for that book.
I love Jesse. And I love how to your books, you know, sometimes you just want to read books that always have happy little endings all tied in a perfect little bow. But I don't want to do too much like spoiler alerts, but
it's not an easy story to read.
No.
But none of the books I write are.
Right. Well, those are the ones I love.
Well, those are the kind of books I read. I mean, I think people think I'm a little bit insane when I say I love Cormac McCarthy. And I love him because, you know, he's got kind of a very unique and different way of writing. And I've often heard that phrase that when you're good enough to break the rules, you can break the rules. And he's one of those writers that's good enough to break the rules.
Yes.
And one of the things that he does that's very unique to him is he will join together common everyday words and almost make it look like a brand new word. And I can't think of anything right off the top of my head, but it'll be like, something, some sort of description, maybe about a structure, or he'll anyway, he just combines the two words together. It could be something as simple as door shut or shut door. You know what I'm saying? And that's not a great
William
example, but it's joined together. So that's, he's maybe one of the first ones that wrote without quotes, when people were talking. So as other writers do that now too. Anyway, so, but he writes very, very dark and very taboo subjects. But one of my favorite books of his, and this is a very twisted and sick book, so I don't know what that says about me, but Child of God. The character in Child of God is not right in the head, and he does these very, very sick things, but it's almost funny. It's like this dark humor. Have you read that book by
Yes, I
chance?
have. And that's when people say, ask me all the time, what makes you think, like the difference in Southern writing and like the ability to turn terrible things, make you laugh while you're also cringing as you're reading.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, let's face it, because this isn't about my book, we'll give a spoiler. It's about necrophilia. Yuck. He gives you the heebie-jeebies just, but he was able to pull it off
Right.
and
Yes.
actually make you feel sympathetic
Yes.
towards this very sick individual, Lester Ballard. But there was one of his books that I read, Sutri, that I really couldn't quite get into. It was almost like it was disgusting for the sake of being disgusting. And I was just like, okay, this, I mean, I, you know, I've got a very strong constitution, but there were points and times in that book where I was like, ugh,
A little
okay,
too much.
this is about to make me sick.
Well, I'm the same way, Charles Bukowski. So I love his poems, but not all of them. It's the same thing. Like The Laughing Heart is one of the most beautiful things I've ever read. Like it's beautiful. And then that same book as you're reading, then it's like, if you're sitting out somewhere, you're like, oh, I hope nobody's looking over my shoulder. Like, I hope nobody's
Well,
like, this is
I will
terrible.
admit, I don't really read poetry, but I will say this. I was just recently gifted a book that's a biography written by a gentleman named Lewis Bowling. And I came to know Lewis Bowling. Matter of fact, I just posted about this out on Instagram. I came to know Lewis Bowling through the Sand Hills Magazine, and they did an article, a short article in Sand Hills Magazine on the Saints of Swallow Hill. And through him reading the book, he put the article out there, and his wife Beth ended up inviting me to one of her book events. She's a member of the Beta Iota chapter of one of the sororities, as like an honorary teachers organization. And so I spent, it's been about a month ago, I spent a Saturday afternoon at the Durham Library, and I was gifted that book that I posted about, and it's just simply called Sam Regan. It's about a gentleman that grew up here in North Carolina, and he was a poet. And so Lewis Bowling wrote this book about him. And he's called or known as the North Carolina Literary Godfather. And there was just
Oh,
this nice note inside by Lewis. But the main thing I wanted to say is that, and I've been flipping through the book, Sam Regan evidently was the sort of poet that if you didn't read poetry, he makes you want to read poetry. And I can already see that. So I haven't had a
wow.
chance to read this book yet, but I've just kind of flipped through it and get stuck on a poem that he's written. And so I can see that I could lean into some of it. Right.
Yeah, how you say you lean
But
into
there's some
it.
of it that you can get into.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you another, he's a young poet, and he's actually the son of somebody that you and I probably both know. And I have often said to her, even though I'm not one to read poetry, he would make me read poetry and can make me love it. And that's Barbara Claypole White. Do you know
Yeah.
her? Yeah. Her son, Zachariah Claypole White, writes poetry and is actually attending university on a scholarship for his work. And he has been published in several, periodicals, magazines. He's just very talented. And so he's another one, and I don't know where he is in his journey right now, but he did get a scholarship, a very talented young man. And he has written a couple of things that just, got me right here.
Oh, I'll have to check it out.
Yeah. You'll have to get in touch with her because I'm not sure where his poems appear. Lots of different magazines have published his work. Anyway.
Nice. Well, that's fun. I was going to ask you like what you've been reading. So we've covered that.
Yeah. Well, I actually have a stack of books here I was going to show you. Now, do you want me to do that?
Yeah, let's go in and into that.
Okay. Well, so one of the questions I think that you had for me is what I've been reading lately. And I'm about to finish this book. I don't know why I didn't finish it last night. I was just so tired. But this book here is Loving the Dead and Gone by Judith Turner Yamamoto. And I have loved this book. It is a story of generations of women, very literary, but I almost look at it like Southern fiction. I'm not sure, if she considers it Southern fiction, but that's how it reads to me. So this one, I'm about to finish it.
And beautiful
cover. The title is phenomenal. So I've been reading that. This was my favorite book of last year.
Oh.
This came out a while back, but I absolutely love this book. And I wrote about, anybody that wants to see anything about what I've got to say about a book, I do reviews out on Goodreads, and my reviews are always encouraging and positive. So this is definitely one of my favorite books. And it deals with two women who are out on a prairie setting, very rural kind of setting. They need each other. It was tough living back then, early 1900s, just my kind of read.
Yeah.
Paulette Giles is one of my favorite authors. I have been going through her books. It started with News of the World. But I think my favorite book of hers is Enemy Women. I love that one, but this is one of hers that I just finished, and it's an excellent book. All of her books are based around the Civil War time frame, either during the Civil War or maybe during Reconstruction. And I got on a Colson Whitehead kick, and I read both of these, loved them. I would say I would go with Nickel Boys as my favorite so far, of his work. And then the last one I was going to show you, because I could do this all day. This is a book that's coming out here in a couple of weeks, February 28th.
Oh, that cover.
This is by a French author, and I was asked if I would read it and blurb it if I loved it. Well, I loved it. It's what they call French noir. There's my blurb right there on the back. I'd have to put my glasses on to be able to read it. But Ron Rash also blurbed it, coming out February 28th, Wind Drinkers. It's a great book. So that's my reading has been lately.
Oh my gosh. I'm going to have to write down some of those. Some of those I've read. But though, Wind Drinkers, that's such a simple cover. And the title.
Yeah. Ooh. The title makes sense once you get into it, but it has to do with four siblings. It's a little bit, so it's French noir, but it also to me had almost an essence of, I don't want to say magical realism, but I would say like apocalyptic, kind of like a post-apocalyptic. I couldn't really get a sense of, okay, exactly when is this? And to me, it had because it was either during like maybe sometime in the early 1900s, or it was like post-apocalyptic. I don't know, but it was just good. I was like flipping pages.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Right.
So we've got some stuff to put on our lists.
Yes.
Have you been compared or had an endorsement written for one of your books that you're just really still so proud of that you think of?
Well, I have been compared. Actually, my agent drew my attention to this and said, frame it. And that was not from an official endorsement, but it came from a reviewer. And I've had one reference made twice, and that was to John Steinbeck. And another one, I know, I was like, really? Okay. You know,
I see
make
that.
my day. And then another one was William Faulkner. The person actually the one that my agent said, frame it, they actually said reminiscent of William Faulkner and John Steinbeck. I said, I'll take it.
Oh my gosh, I would have that blown up framed.
Post it right there, you know,
Yeah,
near your computer as you're
right over it as you just
walking.
glance. Yeah, I mean, that's good stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so let's see. This is so fun.
It is.
So, what are you working on now?
Well, actually, there's a couple things going on. Number one, and I put this out on Facebook, and I think I wrote it out on my blog. I tend to kind of, when I'm not doing my first sentence Fridays to introduce a book, I tend to forget sometimes that I have this blog, you know, and I'll look at it and I'll go, oh, I haven't posted anything in a while. So just recently I posted in some news. And what the news was is I had a publication date for book number 6, and that is February of 2024. And that's my Civil War book. I had a title for it, but the title has been changed. And I'm
Oh.
not going to share what the title is yet. Because we just this week, yesterday, it was finalized. And I know they're working on the cover. And so I thought, well, it would be nice just to kind of package it all up together, do the cover, do the new title. And plus, I have the flap copy. They've already written that. It's beautiful. I love it. That book is coming out, and I'm really excited about it because it's such a different time frame, you know, for me to write in. I wasn't prepared to write a Civil War book, but I was struggling to find the topic for my next story after Saints of Swallow Hill. Saints is a hard book to follow because there was just so much about that story that resonated with me as a writer, where I found myself doing what they call like breaking through in particular scenes. And so I just felt like it was a very different book from my first four books because all of those are coming of age stories written in the first person. And Saints is written in third person point of view from the perspective of two different characters. You know, they're adults. That whole thing was just so different. So anyway, I was struggling to try to find what I was going to write about next. And my husband had said this more than once. And he said it again when I was coming up with all of these different topics. Maybe I should write about this. Maybe I should write about this. And he kept saying, I don't see why you don't write about the Civil War. He said, you know, what is it that you have on your website? It's, I guess, a byline. And it's that I write about family hardship and troubled times in a bygone South. He said, I don't know of any more troubled times than the Civil
Exactly.
War. You know?
Yeah.
And I mean, I was like, I just was like, no. And then it just kind of dawned on me, why not? And then I wanted it to be very different. And it is a different kind of Civil War book because I don't have the characters take a position. My main character, Joetta McBride, she and her family are subsistence farmers and they've never had slaves. They don't want to have anything to do with the war. They're neutral and they're trying to maintain their neutrality until their oldest son is influenced by his grandfather and he runs off to join, which is what a lot of boys did back then. He's 15, you know, and that's what he did. Well, this sets in motion a chain of events that causes the Ennis, who is Joetta's husband, to go look for him. And then he ends up conscripted, which means he is in it now for 3 years. So whether they wanted to be a part of it, or, and this is all spoiler free, this is all like at the very beginning, but whether he wanted to be in it or not, you know, they're in it. But she continues to stay behind and to do just like what a lot of women did, which is to keep up the farm. And it's a very, very hard, hard time for them, as you can imagine. Civil War was, you know, just that dark period in our history. And she continues to try to maintain that neutrality and she becomes a pariah in the community.
Oh, so what point of view is it written in?
Joetta's point of view only, and it's third person.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm excited. When can we get that?
Well, let's see. So February is when it comes out next year. So exactly a year from this month. Of course, I will probably get advanced reader copies. I don't know exactly when, but maybe sometime over the summer, I'm sure. It seems like they usually come about 6 months before the publication date. You know, it just seems like everything starts to happen really quick, at least for me, in my mind. Because I was thinking about it the other day and I was going through my calendar figuring out, okay, when do I need to start First Sentence Fridays? Because the book has got 32 chapters. So for 32 weeks, people got to deal with me doing a weekly post and introducing the first sentence of each chapter and
sort
of writing a little bit about it. I've been doing that since Dixie Dupree. So I have two Facebook accounts. I've got a personal account. And I've got an author page, and it comes out on the author page because my website is linked to automatically post to that. You can only choose one. Yeah.
Author page that I just ignore.
Well, to be honest with you, you know, it's kind of cumbersome to have the two. I almost wish I had done one or the other. Because a lot of times what I post on my author page, I end up posting on my personal page because I have a lot of readers that I feel like don't know that I'm, you know, that I have an author page, and I like to grow any followers organically. If you want to come and pay attention to what I'm doing, come on, you know, I roll out the red carpet for you, but I don't send out invites. I don't ask people to like my page. And, you know, I want people to come because they want to be there.
Like, I've got some reading to catch up on. So I haven't read The Giving Kind yet. The one that I haven't read yet of yours.
You know, it's interesting about that book. My publisher, that you know, they make smart decisions when it comes to promoting the book. That was part of a two-book contract. So The Forgiving Kind and The Moonshiner's Daughter were a two-book contract. And they put more into the promotion of The Moonshiner's Daughter than they did The Forgiving Kind. So I feel like The Forgiving Kind, you know, is not well known by many readers. But the interesting thing that has happened, and this happens with every author, it's not happening to just me, like Colleen Hoover, for instance, you know, she has taken off with all of her work. And so people are now finding her backlist. And that's what's happening with me, is a lot of people are finding my backlist, which is The Education of Dixie Dupree, The Road to Bittersweet, The Forgiving Kind, and The Moonshiner's Daughter. And all of those books, you know, are selling more now than they did before. What I was going to say about The Forgiving Kind that's interesting is it is actually my highest rated book out on Goodreads.
Yeah.
It's getting like Saints is like 4.13. And do I pay attention to this? Yes, I do. let's see. The Moonshiner's Daughter and I want to say The Road to Bittersweet are equal, like 4.24. But The Forgiving Kind is 4.32. So,
wow.
You know, it's the highest rated book.
Isn't that
people love it. They
well,
love
I think now, okay, if my to be read list is so huge.
I can probably show you mine. You see the bookshelves there behind me?
Yes.
Well, it goes almost up to, you can't, all of those books that are over there, and there's another shelf you can't see because this shelf here is, I'm actually sitting and, you know, my, that's like right there. But I just had these, my husband built these for me, he and his guys, for Christmas. But those, that to be red shelf is 1, 2, 3, 4 stacked high and it's full. So
all those are to be read.
Yes. Yes.
But isn't it great though? Because books don't go bad.
I love it. I love it. And then over here to my, this, well, it's to my left. It's, I'm probably pointing to your right. And then right above me are all my Stephen King books. But over here are all my books that I've read. And it's equivalent to two whole sections here, top to bottom. And I've given away Oh my gosh, to the libraries. I take all of my books off to the library that, and then I've got the ones that I'm going to keep.
Yeah, that you just can't get rid of.
Yeah, I don't want to, I mean, they're the ones that are special to my heart, like all of my Kay Gibbons books, my Dorothy Allison books. I have all, every book that those authors have ever written. My Cormac McCarthy collection. Of course, Brad Watson died too soon, and he had a couple of books out. I've got those. My Larry Brown collection, big Mississippi writer.
I
So
love
anyway,
Larry Graham.
yeah, he's good. I should, and I, you know, I have this list of authors that I want to read. Like, you're gonna think I'm nuts. Guess who I haven't read? That's huge, huge to you, and particularly probably to you and many, many other people. I'm gonna get up and get the book. Hold on.
Okay.
I'm almost embarrassed. I've got them though. So those are just some of the ones that I need to get to,
Oh, but that's so cool though, because, and this is what's so neat. You were saying how The Forgiving Kind, how it is just now, people are starting to really pick it up and read it. Well, I think that's what's so cool about book, is I don't mind that some of my to be read are not going to be read for another year or two. I mean, I hate not to help be promoting the authors right when they come out, but it's also good to have readers promoting the books after so they're not forgotten. So,
Exactly. Yeah.
okay, so let's talk about the essay that you wrote for
Okay.
Where I Read, about your publication process. I actually titled it Education in Determination.
Oh, I love that. I
Because
love that.
that's
Because I didn't
exactly
put a
what.
title to it for sure. I just,
But I thought it worked perfect because that's you
it
were so
does.
determined.
It does. That's great. I love it.
I'm so glad you did not give up.
Here's what's scary. Here is what is so scary about it. And I mean, it's what I said in the essay. I know, and I mean, I can't be 100% sure of this, because as years go by, we end up in different places. We feel differently about things. We grow, we mature. We hope we do, learn from our lessons, try to. But at that company that I was working for, I had been there for 25 years. And I had been with an IT company for 10 years, approximately 10 years before that. So, I mean, my background is information technology, and I'd been in it for almost 35 years. And yes, I had this dream of writing, but quite honestly, if Nortel had not gone bankrupt, I sometimes wonder if I wouldn't still be there. Doing, working towards my retirement. That was in 2012 when I left the company. So it's hard for me to imagine that it has been as long as it has, but going on 11 years now, next month. And that's about the time that I've been with my agent now, too. And that was one of the things that I was updating in the essay. Yeah, that's almost scary to think about because sometimes I'm the type of person that I want to do something, but I'm leery about doing, it's almost, I can't say that I like assurances, like it's going to turn out like this. You can never have a guarantee. I almost have to be shoved off the cliff, to do certain things. And that's what that bankruptcy did. Now, I mean, it's not to say that I was already working very well, I wasn't really working very hard to become a writer. But I started working really hard to become a writer once I realized, well, my IT career, at least at this point, is over and done with. Yeah.
Everybody's stories are so amazing.
Very different.
Oh, sorry.
He agreed. He or she won.
It's really interesting how, you just think your life is going one way. And
Yeah.
you think, well, I want this to happen, but like you said, no assurances, right? So before you know it, 1 year's turned into five, and you're still waiting for those assurances. And it's like, wait just a second. Left Vanderbilt after 26 years and just sold my house and gave everything away. And I thought, I really want to write. And I wouldn't have done it, but somebody that I just looked up to said, you're worth it. You're
Yeah.
worth it. And
That's all you need. You've got to have an advocate.
Yeah, you are worth it. And I'm so glad that you did do that because we all are.
Anybody that is attempting to do this, and there's many, many, many people out there, and I know that, and I often think about those individuals. And I mean, I did not know what would become of my writing during that time. I was still at Nortel and I was dabbling with this manuscript. I would read something and I would get motivated again. And just, I had this desire that I wanted to bring out that kind of emotion that I felt when I was reading something that was so good.
Yeah.
And I've talked about this many, many, many times. I am constantly talking about Kay Gibbons and the book Ellen Foster and Dorothy Allison and Bastard Out of Carolina. I can't tell you how many times I have brought up their names and brought up those two books, because those were the two books that more or less gave me the impetus to write. I reread them, multiple times, knew that that was the kind of stories I wanted to tell about these young girls, women who were struggling through some of the most complicated and difficult times in their life. When I think about that whole journey and not knowing where I would end up, that's just like a black hole. It's like looking at a tunnel and there's no end to the tunnel. It's just this, how you go through now, and they've got them, they're all lit up and you can usually
Right.
the light at the end of the tunnel. But there's to me, that it was almost like that. It was like, there's no end in sight. I don't know where this is going. I could be wasting my time. And so I think about that going on in people's heads. And I think about the attempts and all of the rejections and just everything. I can say this, I am grateful every single day of my life that it happened, even though it happened in kind of a very unusual way. It takes luck, a little bit of that luck, and it takes the talent, and it takes that determination, that you were talking about.
Yeah. Ah. So there's something that you would just say, like, just to give them a little boost.
I feel like I've said this before, but I want to go in a little bit of a different way, different angle. I mean, you got to keep writing. That's the main thing, because nothing is going to happen unless you do. It's sort of like, if you think about it, and this is going to probably be a bad analogy, I have to take time when I want to think about analogies, but this is coming off the top of my head. Think about somebody playing golf. They've been playing golf all their life and they want to get a hole in one. Well, they're never going to get a hole in one unless they keep playing golf. So that's kind of a bad analogy, but it's the same thing. You're never going to know if you just, and I understand that rejections are tough. And you might get this many and this many and this many. But one of the most encouraging things that I ever received for myself is to read other people's journeys.
Yes.
Read about, think about Catherine Stockett with the book The Help. I think she had like over 100 rejections. I would say if you are in this realm of the black tunnel with no light at the end of it, if you're writing, and if you've had feedback from other people who say your writing is good, it'll happen, it'll happen, it'll happen. Well, then, you got to keep on. But it also helps, when you get discouraged, to just seek out other people's stories about how their publication took place. Because those are the things that I would read about. And you can find those kind of stories in magazines, like Poet and Writers Magazine, Writer's Digest. Excellent, excellent one for covering all of those kind of stories. You can find them online, because they were always encouraging to me, because it took years. First of all, there was the working with a freelance editor, and that started in 2011. And then there was the, ooh, I got an agent, but then the book didn't sell for like 3 years. And I mean, you talk about discouraging. There's a completed book that everybody was enthralled with, and it looked like it wasn't going to sell. And that's a hard thing to do, to put something up that you're so passionate about and what you've worked on for years.
Well, and two, when you have an agent who is excited about it, like yours was, yeah, and then for it not to happen, that's
Was.
a real big kick, punch in
That definitely
the
sustained me for a long time.
gut.
But then it got to the point where it was like I said, the panic writing. I did that, you know, because it's like, can I even do this again? You know. But, you know, the advice for writers is always going to be the same. You've got to keep writing and you've got to keep trying because it will happen. You know, sooner or later, persistence pays off. There's all kinds of ways to also feed that need for, you know, like if you're feeling down in the dumps and you just need that boost. And that's going to be being part of your, you know, writers groups and yes. other individuals who are following that same path. That was something that I got a lot of, just felt like it would lift my spirits, you know, when I could commiserate with someone else that was going through the same things. Talk about it.
You know? A writer support group.
Exactly. Exactly.
Just as important as the critique groups and the advanced readers.
Yeah, having that exactly. That's exactly right. You know, yeah. It just helps to talk about it. It makes you feel like you're, like for me, it was always just a big release of tension and the understanding that I'm not alone. There are millions of other people out here who are going through the same thing.
Yeah. Oh, well, I've really enjoyed talking to you.
I enjoy talking to you too. It's been fun. I knew it would be.
Yeah. We're going to have to do it again.
I want to. Absolutely.
Where can readers find you?
Well, everything that's connected with me from my social media presence is on www. I probably don't even need to say that. DonnaEverhart.com.
All right.
So they can connect with me there. I do very, very occasionally a newsletter. I mean, I put one out last year and it was literally one. So I will not be filling up inboxes with newsletters, but I do them. I try to do at least two a year, but last year it was one.
All right. Well, I'll let you get back to it. You've got a new book. It's all finished now, right? You're done?
No, I'm actually working on book number 7. As we speak, I've got a proposal that's due in the middle of April, April 15th. So that'll be book number 7. So the Civil War book comes out February 2024. And now this is book number 7. I won't say too much about it because it's in the proposal stage, but I'm very excited about this one too.
I just got chill bumps again. Well, then you are busy. I better let you go.
Thank you so much, Mandy. I appreciate your time.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for being here.
You have a good day.
You too.